I wanted to speak in the prayer that we said earlier, where it says, do not commit any evil deeds, commit a perfect wealth of virtues, and subdue your mind completely. And this is the teaching of the Buddha. So with regards to the evil deeds, so the cause which gives rise to suffering is called evil deeds. So when we even use the term Digpa in Tibetan, we also use the term in the sense of frightening somebody. And therefore, the cause which gives rise to suffering is called evil deeds or non-virtuous deeds. So something, an action which actually helps somebody, that is called virtue, virtuous action. And therefore, non-virtuous actions or virtuous actions are not absolute existence in themselves. We have to talk about virtue or non-virtue in relation to, non-virtuous actions in relation to the virtuous actions and vice versa. For example, if we talk about killing, lobsang get nashta, pigit get nashta, camera dam ding it, dikke ya kumunda, get chifta. So for a beginner practitioner, if you take somebody's life, the consequence is that you will suffer in the future. Although there may be cases, exceptional cases, where somebody is on a very high level of realization, and in which case they may not accrue that kind of consequence. So, for example, in the case of the Buddha himself, in his past life, he was a captain of a ship, with his retinue of 499 merchants. And there was one person in his group who had this evil thought or the malicious thought of killing the rest of the merchants. Who had obtained gems and treasures from the ocean and were coming back. And so the captain, the Buddha, in that life, advised this person, the evil person, not to have such malicious thoughts and not to actually think of killing the rest of his companions. And so this merchant actually calculated what is the pros and cons in terms of the short and long term benefits. So this So if this person, the malicious person, allowed to kill the rest of these 499 people, and so if this evil person were allowed to kill the rest of the 499 merchants on the ships, so the Buddha saw that he is a danger to these 499 merchants, and he would, if he were to allow to kill them, then he would have the negative karma of killing all these merchants. And if the Buddha actually didn't do anything but let the person take life of 499 people, then of course he wouldn't have the action of karma of killing somebody. And so weighing the pros and cons of these two situations, letting the life the evil person to take the life of the 499, or killing this one single person and saving the 499 lives. And so even if they, by killing the single person, this evil person, what the Buddha would be doing is saving this one person from committing the evil deed of killing 499 merchants. And so, although by killing this one person, the Buddha would accrue the negative action of killing a human being, but he saw the benefit, the long-term benefit of saving this the 499 other merchants, and that helped because it was it was moved by compassionate attitude and motivation. The Buddha was actually going to accrue a huge merit of saving 499 lives, and therefore, virtuous and non-virtuous actions can be understood in relation to one another. There's no absolute virtuous action or karma and non-virtuous karma. On the other hand, if you have a bad ulterior motivation tinged by the eight worldly concerns, even if you may speak nicely, but that would your physical and verbal actions, which would be nice, but that would be rather non-virtuous action because of your motivation. And so in Buddhism, if the reason why we say we must not commit any evil deeds is because in the end you suffer as a consequence of that. It's not just because the Buddha said so, but it's because of this working of causality. And therefore, those actions which give rise to happiness and pleasant experiences for oneself, they are considered virtuous actions. And therefore, since you do not want suffering, avoid suffering. And since you want happiness, create the causes of happiness. And therefore, fundamentally, what all these actions come down to is your mind. And so, this text says, subdue your mind completely. And this is the teaching of the Buddha. So, isn't it nice? So, when it comes to subduing one's mind, what is the mind then? As we are talking about subduing it, what are the different factors which would help to subdue our mind? So, in the some of the people here who are actually have studied the collected topics, which consists of learning about the different definitions and categories of color and so forth, and also you learn about the objects of knowledge, which is defined as those which are objects or which can be objects of one's consciousness or mind. And then, within the objects of knowledge, there are those compounded phenomena and uncompounded phenomena. So do you remember these? So an object of knowledge is divided into these two. And then the compounded phenomena in turn are divided into physical objects, consciousness, and certain abstract phenomena called and its non-associated compositional factors. And then there are definitions of form and so forth. So, and also consciousness, which is defined as that which has clarity and awareness. So you don't just be satisfied with the terms themselves, but you should actually think closely what these two terms, clarity and awareness, mean. In the Dzogchen tradition, they talk about Rigpa Sangtel, breakthrough or of the pristine awareness. But here we are not talking about that kind of high-level attainment or the realization, but on the basic level of consciousness, or which is which has to do with the action of knowing something, and that agent which actually knows something is called a consciousness. When you look at me, you see me. Does your eye see? I mean, does only your eyes consciousness see it, or does your brain also see it? If it's only the eyes that sees me, when you look, while you are looking at me, if you hear some beautiful, interesting music or some terrible sound, what will happen is you'll be distracted by them and you will not be able to ascertain what you are seeing with your eyes. In the study of mind and mental factors, or study of mind, there is one kind of consciousness which is called consciousness which has an appearance of something but is unable to ascertain the object. And while you look, when the eye consciousness is not there, the faculty which is the physical faculty which helps the eye consciousness to arise is still there. For example, if somebody is deeply asleep, you try to open his eyes, his or her eyes, and you'll see the eye faculty is still there. And therefore, we have to understand that the regarding consciousness or mind, it's not just the sensorial consciousness, but there is a mental consciousness as well. So you need to think about it. And classical biologists or neuroscientists would say that there is nothing apart from the brain and the waves or the workings of the brains. And within the brain, there are the prefrontal cortex or something. And amygdala, it has to do with our emotions, which is deep in the brain. And so there are different parts of the brain which work for our visual experience and also experience of hearing sound and so forth. And therefore, because they see, they find that these different parts of the brain working as our sense for hearing and seeing visual objects and so forth, they say there is no consciousness apart from the brain. But as time went on, many scientists are saying that it's not. They have difficulty, it seems, that things and experiences that we have cannot be explained only on the basis of the workings of the brain. Because through training of the mind, people are finding that subtle changes and impact can be made on the brain neurons. And so these transformations or neural changes happen not just because of the interaction of the neurons, but there is another agent. So some well-qualified scientists are saying these kind of things. So I'll leave it here. Oh, there's a debate.
His Holiness has posed the teaching for a while because young school children, children are going to present their debate skills to His Holiness. His Holiness said, right now, His Holiness just said to the children that right now they are debating as a group, but in the future, as they grow up, they have to learn how to debate on their own. So right now they're debating on the definition of colors. So the ones who are standing asked the answerer, what is the definition of color? And the answerer is saying, the definition is that which has color. So now they are going to find out if there are any... they can bring out some contradiction between the definition and in the definition. So they are talking, I think they are right now discussing on the divisions in color, like the root colors and the branch colors like that, and then the definition of what is a root color and what is a branch color. Like, for example, the four root colors are blue, yellow, white, and red. Like that. They are discussing on the color of the white cloud. Is that root color or branch color? So the answer said, yes, it is it is white color, and so it's a root color. You know, something like that. Or in other words, a better translation would be primary colors and secondary colors, rather than saying root colors and branch colors. So now they said "Otsha," which means okay, there you go, you have become speechless. You lost the debate. Now they are discussing on what is milk? Is milk a color or a form? They said milk is not color because it is taste. Taste and color are different, contradictory. So that's how the debate went on. Now the debate is changed. A second group of students came up. The first group sat down. These are slightly senior students, Upper TC. These are from Upper TCV. About 5 girls and 3 boys. And talking about discussing on cause and condition. What is the definition of cause? What is the definition of a country? And what are the 6 types of causes like that? They're asking for the definition of cooperative, which is sort of simultaneous cooperative cause, condition, sorry. Next, they are talking about simultaneous mental, sort of cooperative mental condition, which means our primary mind is always accompanied by a set of five secondary minds, and the three are all these two. These five are always simultaneously present with the main primary mind. So Now they are saying, is your hand, your condition, your cause? That they're saying your hand and you are like the the parts, your hand is like a part of the person, and the part and the person are always they should be simultaneously, and they should be cooperative to each other. So now they have said Tar, which means you are defeated. We have defeated you. Discussing on depending on the definition, you know, each the definition of each of the different kinds of causes and conditions, such as like for example, right now they are talking about pen dog jiggy, which means the cause which is complementary, which complements another object. So, for example, Lord Buddha being our teacher, the children are asking the answer whether the Buddha is your complementary cause, or in other words, your supporting cause. And if the answer is yes, then how can they be cause and condition? Now they are discussing on they are discussing on a ripening cause. So they are saying if something is a ripening cause of something else, does that mean that the cause is either positive or negative? So for example, if yes, the latent imprints in your mind, are these ripening causes or not? Or are they positive or negative? So the point is that if something is a ripening course, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be positive or negative, because there are causes, ripening causes, which are neither of them, and which are, in other words, neutral.
Just praising these children, saying that they've done well. I mean, so in the past years, some of these the TCV students actually had presented debates like this, using the scientific terminology in English, basically speaking in Tibetan, but using those terms in English. But what we need to understand is how the technique that we are using to analyze and investigate into the nature of things, and this can be used in any subjects, science or any other subject. As I have discussions with scientists, some scientists have said, some of these scholars have said, maybe His Holiness is pointing to Mr. Duk Tsering, the director of TCV School in Selakui. You have perhaps heard this. And so some of these scientists have asked me if these, the technique of debate using logic can be used in other subjects like science. In one of the Mind and Life conferences in South India, and many of the scientists have been to the monastic debate courtyards where the monks were debating, and Dien Duk Tsering was also there. His Holiness was asking him if he was there, and so of course, so having seen those monks debating and clapping their hands like these children did here, some of the scientists, even during the Mind and Life conference, when they were arguing with each other, they even acted as if they were in debate courtyards. So although in English, maybe they don't still have the same kind of words that we use for syllogisms or syllogistic logic or ad absurdum logic, but it has to be somehow devised. Amygdala. Amygdala. So he was saying that earlier he didn't remember the word, but now it's, he remembers that it's amygdala. That's part of the brain. Karis. So this man is expressing his experience of having been taking part in the introduction to Buddhism since in the last 6 years. In the beginning, it didn't make much impact on him, but then after studying about the two truths and the four truths, noble truths, what he has felt, he has felt that all sentient beings are kind to us. Mm-hmm. I felt that the fact that we could become enlightened is thanks to sentient beings, and for even our living in this life, we're able to do so in thanks to sentient beings. So in whatever we do, whatever I do, even reciting mantras or working around temples and so forth, everything is I dedicate for sentient beings. And I also remember the kindness of my spiritual masters. And so whatever I do seems to be very beneficial and positive. So what you have actually experienced is what is expressed in this line. Think of that all sentient beings as being kind to you. So for enlightenment or higher rebirths within samsara, all these are thanks to sentient beings, as you have felt, and this is really appreciable. And the purpose of this serves the purpose of having studied the Dharma, and so the bodhicitta is really that factor which makes you feel the purpose of the Dharma. So he's 76 years old. So this is inquired. How many years have you wasted in your life? He's praising His Holiness. May you live long. Your Holiness, champion of peace in the world, omniscient one, at your lotus feet I prostrate countless times. So you are the sole refuge for us who has assumed this monastic human birth and has been carrying out the deeds of all the Buddhas at this degenerate age. So our gratitude to you is something which we cannot repay. Your kindness to us is something we cannot repay ever. So at your behest, the Tibetan children have the opportunity to listen to Buddha Dharma. And I feel from the depth of my heart grateful to you, Your Holiness. So many young people have now found or seen the value of our own cultural tradition. Not only studying the Dharma, but making transformation within. From all angles, I would like to take this opportunity to, on behalf of all the past students and also the current students, I would like to thank Your Holiness for your kindness. Your Holiness, until now, You have given us all kinds of instructions and advice in order to be able to be practical about what we learn about Dharma and to be 21st century Buddhists. So we dedicate all the merits we have accrued through our study and practice for your His Holiness' long life, and may you also shower on us the blessings and your teachings forever. As pure these teachings, as pure as the Brahmaputra River. So we offer this medicine Buddha Thangka to Your Holiness. And so there's some classical scientists, old so of course science developed in the West, and the modern science that we learn came from the West. And where the traditional religious tradition has been Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Of course, these teach, they have the message of altruism, helping others, love and compassion, and so forth, which are very good messages. But when it comes to philosophical explanation of things, I mean, they don't have very much. So when it comes to checking the reality precisely in great detail, they don't seem to have much. To do with that. And then, with regard to science, science has to do with measuring things, quantifying, and in relation to things which are material, physical, mostly. And therefore, this is how the scientists have checked into reality of things with that background. But towards the end of the 20th century, when people took more and more interest in learning about psychology, and then in people who are involved in social work and so forth, they have found that there's lack of moral principles in the whole society. So from the school children up to the highest leaders of the countries, people have found that everyone is more or less engulfed by the negative emotions. And so this has been the kind of habit in the society. And although they find themselves in this kind of problems and difficulties, they didn't have much means to overcome them. And so, as at one time in one of the Western countries, when I met with some scientists and I had discussions, and so the scientists, so one of the main scientists who at that time was a brain scientist, or and so he wasn't actually, he was someone who was saying that there's no other agent called mind or consciousness apart from the mind. But regarding himself, as far as him personally, he had lost his child, a son, not very long time ago, but he was, and therefore he was full of worry. So he somebody who says that it's the brain is the, our mind, and there's no other thing as consciousness apart from that. But he was full of worry, and I felt sorry for him. So I didn't see any reason to tell him that there is something called consciousness apart from the brain. But he was in such a sad situation. And then many years ago, when I was having discussions with some medical scientists or doctors, I told them that do we not have some experiences, like physically we may be very difficult situation, and because of that we have an unhappy state of mind as well. So the biological factor can have some effect on our brain, I mean on our mind as well. I said this is true, but when you are relaxed, completely relaxed, and without any physical discomfort or anything like that, but because of your thought processes going on in your mind, it actually causes you to breathe heavily somehow. So, of course, the physical, we know that our body can affect our mind, but because of the different thoughts that arise in us, that we can also feel, ourselves blushing or feeling some heat in the face. And one of the doctors said, "It seems this is true, but this cannot be the case." So, isn't that too simplistic? So I had such experience with people, but today a very wise, intelligent scientist today are saying that there seems to be something called consciousness, when especially when things get subtler and subtler in experience. And then they come to think there is something called consciousness apart from the brain. And therefore, so when it comes to precisely explaining about psychology, we find today that because of this interaction with scientists, we find the ancient Indian psychology is really helpful. So when you talk about seeing something with your eyes, is it the eye faculty seeing the object or the eye consciousness seeing the object? So, although you may be seeing something with your visual consciousness, but your mind may be thinking about something else. And not only that, when you are asleep, the sensorial perceptions don't work. It's only the mental that is working. So, when you are just asleep, and then there is the consciousness when you dream as well. And so, scientists even are able to see through encephalogram to check dream. EEG. So through their machines, they could see there's someone dreaming when they see the EEG fluctuation. And so people could actually tell that whether somebody is dreaming or in deep sleep and so forth, which are also explained in our texts. So there is consciousness at waking state, dreaming state, deep sleep, and so forth. So So as you debated, the children just debated about six different courses, types of courses. And there are, of course, within the courses, the primary course, and then the objective course, and the empowering course, and so forth. So I have discussions with scientists, and some have even asked me, when it comes to the very subtle neuron or the subtlest particles of the brain itself, the subtlest particles of the rocks and stones and so forth, and the subtlest particle of our brain are same. There's no difference. Subatomic particle, perhaps. I don't remember the terms. So, up to what kind of the development of these particles can a particle become the basis for consciousness? So some scientists are saying that they could even create or invent robots with consciousness. I told them it's difficult. And then there's another reason that we can think. So with regard to the substantial cause of consciousness, there cannot be something which is not consciousness, like physical object, cannot become the substantial cause of consciousness, as it is said in Pramanavartika. Of course, when it comes to Tantra, there is more categorization of this degrees of subtlety within the consciousness. And then one scientist in our discussion, they said that given the situation where you have a perfect womb of a mother without any defect, and then a perfect ovum and perfect sperm, so when these three things which are perfect come together, the ovum and the sperm come together in the mother's perfect womb, so at conception, and just because of these three things, perfect things coming together, is there any guarantee that life will start? And they say that that's not the case. So even though we have a perfect sperm, perfect ovum, and a perfect womb, in which these two actually form a gamete, and there's no guarantee of life starting. And therefore, it shows that there is a third cause that is needed. And therefore, when a consciousness conceives in these two, sperm and the ovum come together, then life starts, it seems. And so, merely basing on science, we cannot explain that. So, on the other hand, when it comes to explaining and describing the physical objects, even in the case of quantum physics, they're able to conclude that nothing objectively exists. So, they're able to say that things are there, and they cannot deny it, but they do not have any objective existence. While things exist, then they do not have any objective existence. The quantum physicists are somehow have a dilemma there to explain how things exist. the existence of the thing. And they talk about an observer. As long as an observer is there, there is an object, observed object. And in Buddhist tradition, according to the Chittamatra philosophy, they say that things do not have any external existence, but they are in the nature of the mind or consciousness. And then when it when the Madhyamakas, the middle way philosophy school of Buddhism, which assert externality of things, it becomes quite complicated to hold on to such view. For example, Bhava Viveka says that external objects do exist, but they do not have any true existence. And then the Madhyamakas, who reject any kind of substantial existence or any kind of self-defined existence, say that there's nothing that exists from the object. This verse that comes from the Chonang tradition is very beneficial to when I think about it. When you think about the objects, there's nothing. They do not have any objective existence, nor the consciousness or the cognition which sees them or perceives them do not have any objective existence. But things come through many different factors coming together, and therefore it's really great to understand that things are merely designated. So with regard to this explanation from the Madhyamaka philosophical point of view, that things do not have any objective existence, whatever. It has given lots of problems to Indian masters, scholars of different philosophies, as well as Tibetan scholars. But in quantum physics, they are able to see that they are not able to pinpoint anything that exists objectively. But they are more or less oriented towards material things. But in our system, seeing things to have some objective existence is seen as a distorted view, and that has to be overcome. So we are not. Even if we do not talk about past and future lives, but even for this life alone, the philosophical explanations are very profound, and they are very much relevant in today's world, and necessary for people to be aware of. And then within the mind there is the mental consciousness, and within that there are the direct perceptions and conceptual mind. And conceptual minds are said to work with their objects through the principle of exclusion, whereas the direct consciousness do not go through that process. I was trying to explain this verse, which says not committing any evil actions, committing a wealth of virtues, and subduing your mind thoroughly. So, of course, today everyone is talking about peace in the world, but peace does not come through our prayers alone. This is very clear to us, because if it were the case that peace could come through prayer, we would have achieved it by now. And not through prayers, like recitation of mantras, which you may do to the point, to such an extent that your fingers and the mala beads would wear out. But one Tibetan master, Zhang Lawa, had made some prophecy about the time, that this tragic time that we are going through. I was given the text by somebody in the past. So this person, Zhang Lawa, has said that through the recitation of mantras, we are not able to exhaust or wear out our negative emotions, but our nails wear out. So because of reciting the mantras so many times, so as Tibetans, we have maybe the prayers and the rituals would have some effect on an individual level, but when it comes to the whole Tibetan cause, it's very difficult that these prayers and rituals would work. We have done so much prayers and rituals in the past, and then there were some cases where that people have said that, oh, there were some good indications from this prayer, but we have not been able to avert the situation that we are now in. And so some people might note down what kind of dreams they had when they did certain prayers and rituals. But what we actually need to do, most importantly, is to discipline our mind. And we need, for that, what actually causes this undisciplined mind, unruly mind here? What kind of thoughts and states of mind cause this? And these are called negative or destructive emotions, disturbing emotions, which make us feel unhappy, disturbed. So the term Nyun Mong also has the connotation of overcoming us and overpowering us. So because of our fear and anxiety, then we also become sometimes angry, and then we blindly do things without any wisdom. Whereas if you are able to deal with things with compassion, and you are able to see the reality, I mean, analyze or investigate into the reality, and then you are able to sometimes find the techniques to overcome certain unwanted situations. So violence or anger are signs of weakness. They're not strengths, inner strength, but because of your fear, you actually become unable to think properly, and you just have this anxiety and So when you look at me, you see me, you'll say that your consciousness sees me, and you can also say that your mind or mental consciousness sees me. But then you will also say, I see you, or I see this and that. So there comes this I, or the person. So the differentiation the delineation of Buddhist and non-Buddhist philosophy comes here. So in the non-Buddhist traditions, they say that there is a self or an Atman, which is not the body, but it comes from the past life and goes from here to the next life, and therefore they say that there is an Atman, an independent or separate self, which is non-changing or unchanging, and it's not produced by adventitious causes. And it's just a single entity. So, from the Buddhist point of view, it is said that if there were such an Atman, then you cannot talk about becoming, I mean, being young, old, sick, and healthy, and so forth, because this self that you are talking, referring to, doesn't have anything to do with the body. And therefore, it shows that the self is related with this body and the mind. And therefore, since they're related, the self is related to the body and the mind, in Buddhism, we say that the self is designated on the basis of the mind and the body. So one time I was in Amritsar at an interfaith conference, and at that conference one Sufi scholar, a professor, had come. Sufism is part of Islam, but slightly different from the other denominations. And so they have their main center in Ajmer. And so recently, the head of the Ajmer Sufi center, I invited him here in Dharamsala. And so this one Sufi scholar said that all religious traditions answer three questions. The first one has to do with what is I, or who am I? And the second is whether it has a beginning or not. And then third one, whether it is an end or not. And so, regarding the first question, it is can be explained differently. So Buddhists say that there is no substantially, self-sufficiently existing self. Whereas apart from Buddhism, all the other religious traditions do assert such a substantially existing self. So Christianity and Islam may not have very precise or detailed explanation of the self as such like that, but they do in reality assert that kind of self. And there is no self. So Buddhism says that there is no self or Atman or soul apart from the mind and body, but the others do assert that. And then the second question, regarding the second question, which is whether this self or soul has a beginning or not. So, from the Buddhist point of view, whether you say it has a beginning or not has to be explained on the basis of the mind and the body, the continuity. And so, since the mind becomes the basic basis for designation of self, and since the mind itself cannot have any beginning to it, and therefore we cannot have a beginning of a self. So this is what the Buddhists, what Buddhism would say. And then regarding the, so with regard to the same, whether there's a beginning to the self or not, according to the theistic religions, they would say that this life itself was created by God, and so there is a beginning. So that's very simple. And in non-Buddhist traditions, there are those who say that, of course, in the beginning, people or beings were created by God. But then, after that, because of our karma, we go through this samsaric existence. And regarding the third question, whether self has an end or not, according to the theistic religions, for example, they say that at the end there is a judgment day, and when God will check whether beings would go to heaven or hell at that time, on that judgment day. And so after reaching heaven or hell, then what happens after that? Nobody is really clear. So according to the Sankhya school, from some discussions I had with some Hindu scholars and practitioners, they say that after somebody reaches an, what they call moksha, then the conscious self remains. According to Jainism, they do also assert a soul. So non-theistic Sankhya, Jainism and Buddhism would say that there is no end to the self. But within Buddhism, there is one sub-school of Vaibhashika who say that when one becomes an arahat and then one dies after that, then nothing is left of oneself. Whereas when we talk about attaining Buddhahood, what is said is that this mind that we have now becomes ultimately the mind of a Buddha when it is freed from all defilements. So we'll have a break here for 15 minutes. Please visit the loo. Question and answer starts. So can there be Buddhists who do not take refuge in the three jewels? So we have started the question and answer session here. So whether the delineation of whether somebody is a Buddhist or not, a non-Buddhist, on the one hand is done on the basis of taking refuge. If you have a sincere sense of taking refuge in the three jewels, you are a Buddhist. But then there is also another way of differentiating between Buddhist and non-Buddhist, which is on the basis of the philosophical view. For example, you may have faith in the Buddha, but because of your philosophical view, assertions with regards to this maxim, which is called the four seals of Buddhism, that all composite compounded phenomena are impermanent, that everything that is contaminated is in the nature of suffering, that everything is empty and selfless, and that nirvana is peace. And so when you delineate somebody as Buddhist or not, on the basis of philosophical view like that, then there are there is a sub-school of Vaibhashika called Vatsiputras, who say that there is a self which is inexpressible. But although this people who assert this view have faith in the Buddha, still, from the point of view of the philosophical view, they are not yet Buddhists as such. So when you talk about taking refuge in the Buddha, to have a sincere, a very good faith in the Buddha, you need to understand that the Buddha is called the teacher, and the Dharma is the actual refuge, and the Sangha are those who assist us on the path, and therefore the Buddha is not the actual refuge. The actual refuge is the Dharma jewel. And within the Dharma jewel, the Dharma jewel is twofold, which is to say that it comprises the true cessation and true path. So when you feel that it would be good if I could attain cessation, true cessation, and then have the motivation to reach that goal, and firstly, you would have a admiration, a faith, which is called admiration, admiring faith. And then you have the trusting or confidence, faith in terms of confidence and finding confidence in the Dharma. And you want to actualize the Dharma within yourself. And by understanding the Dharma well, being able to feel certain about the Dharma jewel itself, you'll be able to see that the Buddha is a unique, is someone who teaches in accordance with reality. And therefore, you are able to take refuge in the Buddha as well. So as Buddhists, usually we are not able to understand what the Buddha is or who the Buddha is, and also the Dharma. And similarly, we consider someone who is wearing some yellow robe is a Sangha. But with that kind of quality of understanding the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you will not be able to take a sincere refuge in the three jewels. When I was once visiting Jispa, on the road, I stopped at some place, a village, and met the local villagers. And at that meeting, there is in that area the Gandapadas, mountain. So I don't know whether this hill is, or the mountain is named after the Mahasiddha Gandapada, or just because the mountain itself has the shape of a bell. But anyway, I visited that sacred hill in my early years when I was young. And so it actually is behind the Rotang Pass. So after having crossed the Rotang Pass, I reached that village and I told them at the meeting that you are all Buddhists, aren't you? And they said yes. And when I asked them, what is Buddhism about? Then they said, they recited this verse of taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So I said, that's right. And then I asked them, what is the difference between Brahma, Indra, and the Buddha? And they said, there is no difference. So they actually equated Brahma with the Buddha. So that shows their ignorance about what the Buddhism and is about. And so they do take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, but they don't understand the, these three jewels well. This is a prayer to the lamas, all the root and lineage lamas, who are the embodiment of the three jewels. So with this prayer for the long life of His Holiness, Truptashi. So he was talking about having studied the four philosophical tenets of Buddhism, and having studied them, when I thought about it, I'm not clear about what are the relationship between these four philosophical schools. So how would Chittamatras and Madhyamakas explain about these atomic and subatomic particles? I think basically that's the question. So as I explained before, yesterday, when he first taught the Four Noble Truths, he did teach about empty and selflessness. But this is more; these are more precisely and in greater detail explained in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. So the four philosophical schools within Buddhism, of course, were taught by the Buddha himself. But when the Nalanda masters have made this more clear, clarify them and explain them in greater detail. So in order to understand the philosophical tenets well, we should study Bhava Viveka's blades of reasoning, Tarka Jivala. It's there you find very clear mention of the different philosophical schools. In the text, when Bhava Viveka rejects or refutes the Chittamatras, the mind-only school, he says that some Bhava Viveka says that Asanga and Vasubandhu are quite shameless to interpret the teaching of the Buddha when it comes to the final view differently from Master Nagarjuna. And in the Tibetan tradition, amongst the Tibetan masters, Kungyen Lokchen Rabjampa has written the Treasury of Tenets. But you find in greater detail the explanations of these philosophical tenets in Kungyen Lama Jamyang Shepa's text on the philosophical systems. And then Kuncho Jigme Wangpo has a shorter version of the philosophical tenets. When it comes to talking about the profundity of these philosophical views, all the four schools, of course, explain the selflessness with the view of selflessness. But what we have to actually check is how the effectiveness of these views against the grasping at some kind of independent self.
Mm-hmm.
although in the Vaibhashika and Swatantrika traditions, they do establish selflessness of persons, but they have they do not have the way to establish selflessness of phenomena as such. But in the Chittamatra and the Madhyamaka traditions or philosophical traditions, there are more detailed explanations of both selflessnesses. And within the certain Chittamatras, there are those of the Chittamatras who are called the Chittamatras asserting true aspect and false aspects and so forth. So when you think about the selflessness of a person, for example, thinking that there is no self substantially existing sufficient self, of course it will help to reduce the holding on to some kind of a solidity in the self. But so when you have this view of sufficiently substantially existing self, you think about my mind, you also have the same kind of feeling would also be tinged with this view. Whereas if you say there's no self, It can help reduce some kind of holding on to solidity of the self and the aggregates. But when it comes to actually understanding that the selflessness of phenomena, it helps to reduce the holding on, this clinging to the, some kind of a solidity in the aggregates as well. As it is said in Bodhisattva Charyavatara, once you have the understanding of the lack of true existence, if you don't have the understanding of the lack of true existence, even if you may reject some kind of a selfhood in things, you will not be able to do away with that kind of clinging to some form of self, which is held as truly existent. So it's not enough to say the physical aggregates do not exist, although the Chittamatras do say that there's no external phenomena. Whereas when it comes to the Madhyamakas, they say that there's nothing which exists truly. And within the Madhyamaka tradition, there are those Madhyamaka sub-schools like the Bhavivekas system of Madhyamaka, which accepts some form of self-defined, self-characterized phenomena, still while rejecting any true existence in things. And therefore, Bhavivika wrote his text from that point of view, he was rejected or refuted in the Prasanapada by Chandrakirti. And because of this discussion or debate back and forth between Bhavivika and Chandrakirti, the position of the Madhyamaka as to how to reject any self-defined character or true existence in things becomes clear. And then there's the question of whether the object of negation, when you establish emptiness, that object of negation would appear to the sensory perception or not. This seems to be a very important question. So if you are able to actually compare and contrast the different explanations, commentaries of the Master Nagarjuna and his disciples, such as the text written by Master Tsongkhapa and others. I mean, it's not. It would be very helpful to understand very precisely. So, in Tsongkhapa's writings, this is very clearly explained. Whether the object of negation appears to sensory perception or not. And when I look at you, for example, you do appear as if there is some objective existence in you. And just as there is this appearance, I also have the feeling of my experiences of mind also having some kind of objective existence. So if you were able to conclusively decide that things do not have any existence the way they appear to us, then you'll be able to see things are like the illusion. And so when you are able to understand that, when you are able to see the illusory nature of things, then it helps to reduce your negative emotions. As I have said yesterday, Aaron Beck has said that when you become angry at somebody, 90% of that negativeness that you see in the person is your own mental projection. And therefore, similarly here, when you are able to ascertain that things do appear to you as something truly independently existing, but there is no such an existence. It does not exist. Things do not exist in that way. So, Chittamatras, of course, reject any externality, but Madhyamakas say that whatever there is in the to know the object and the subjective mind, everything is empty of any true existence. And they were able to understand the illusory nature more precisely. And the one person who has been instrumental in piquing my interest in the Madhyamaka philosophy was Geng Odup Chogye, a Mongolian scholar. So of course I still cannot claim to have the true experience, real experience of Madhyamaka view. But then I have taken the different steps in the process of developing my understanding of leading my development in the understanding of the emptiness. And so, when I first had the experience, I had this feeling that I do not exist. But when I was, when I developed this further, my understanding of emptiness, I could now see that things, it makes sense when you say that things are merely designated. And so, since suffering of sentient beings are because of it's because of our ignorance. I could see that overpowered by this illusion, the ignorance, sentient beings are suffering, and therefore it also helps to feel compassion and also generate or bodhicitta within myself. And so, with regard to compassion, that the strength of the degree of this compassion is different between the Shravakas and the Mahayana practitioners or bodhisattvas. So when it comes, when you are able to understand the Madhyamaka philosophy from the point of view of Prasangikas, saying that things do not have any true existence, well, then any kind of negative emotions that arise through holding on to some true existence may not appear. while this realization is still actively working. Whereas if you have only the understanding of emptiness from the point of view of the Savatantrika Madhyamaka's philosophical point of view, then there is still some form of clinging to some objective existence in things. And accordingly, you also have negative emotions and arising on that basis. Whereas if you are able to establish or ascertain that nothing whatever has any true or independent existence, even in convention, then that realization will help in curbing or stopping you from having this the negative emotions arising on the basis of that clinging to true existence. So if you are able to actually give work against this clinging to true existence, even in convention, and then you'll be able to overcome or fight against the negative emotions that arise from clinging to, for example, substantial existence or regarding myself, because of having meditated on this philosophical view of emptiness from the point of view of the Prasangika's philosophy, then I could say that in my mind, the desire ram attachment does not arise. And this is not through meditation on developing the concentration rams, I mean, concentration practices, but by meditating on emptiness, according to the Prasangika Madhyamaka view. So with the paid homage to the Buddha, using Master Nagarjuna's line, in 2015, I had the opportunity to ask Quint about, I asked about how to meditate. And it really was beneficial for me, Your Holiness, your advice on meditation. So I do meditation on impermanence and death, and also how to generate renunciation or the determination to be free. So I wish His Holiness, Your Holiness, to explain the processes leading to that. So he said that he does this meditation every morning. He's only saying it's very good that you are taking interest in meditation and doing this. So the purpose of meditation or the purpose of doing Dharma practice is to discipline your mind. So if you, having studied the Dharma, if you don't give thought to it and reflect on it, this will not help to combat your negative emotions. We have geishas initially who, when they came from their own homeland in Tibet, were very humble, but as they progress in their study and become geishi and have more students, then they become more and more puffed up. So that's not really good. Therefore, what we need to be able to do is to cultivate the threefold qualities of learned one, being learned, humble, and gentle. And so our learning should actually complement being kind and gentle and humble. as the old man earlier had said, that you do not just think of yourself alone, but think of helping and benefiting others. And therefore, you should develop the three qualities of being learned, humble, and sincere, and also good and kind person. So there are... So in Tibet, we used to think that lamas who sit on thrones have these three qualities, but in reality, it's a question whether they really are qualified with these qualifications. So when through our learning, if we are able to become learned, sincere and humble and kind and gentle, then we would be all Tibetans, everyone. We have the language, which is an excellent language, and also we have the materials for creating ourselves and creating these three qualifications within ourselves. So we need to put effort, use our potential. So by using the knowledge that we have in the Kanjur and Tenjur literature, so I do my best to have these qualities, three qualities. We as Buddhist followers of the Nalanda tradition, so as a follower of the Nalanda tradition, I do aspire to develop these threefold quality, and we should, as Tibetans, do the same. He said, I prostrate to you, Your Holiness. I am in class 12, grade 12, science. I have... So he's interested to pursue psychology and neurology, neuroscience. Although I have this aspiration, but I am an ordinary person who's full of the negative emotions. So please explain how to combat the negative emotions, particularly ignorance and anger. So regarding the combating the ignorance, I, whom you call as omniscient victorious one, I have worked for over 60 years to combat ignorance. What has happened to me is I have studied the text and have then reflected on the meaning of these teachings. And so there's no... I don't have some solid gift that I can give you to combat the ignorance. As Buddha himself has said, the Buddhas do not wash away the sins of sentient beings, nor do they pick out or take away or remove the suffering of sentient beings. Nor do they transport their realizations, but only by teaching the suchness of reality, they help sentient beings to lead to liberation. So Nyingguan Tsongrapa has said, who was a great scholar and master, a practitioner of non-sectarian tradition, he has said that rather than doing meditation on Manjushri for a month, where you recite the Manjushri mantra and visualizations, it would be better to more effective if you study the collected topics for 1 month. So loving kindness, compassion, and bodhicitta cannot serve as direct antidote to our ignorance, which is a distorted view of reality. And so this should be or must be overcome by developing the wisdom, realizing emptiness. And this has to arise through our study, reflection, and meditation. And it's not easy. So your aspiration to pursue neuroscience is very good. Over 50 years, 40 years ago, even as in my childhood, I was very interested by science. And therefore, over 40 years ago, I asked some of my friends, I told some of my friends that I have some interest in having discussions with scientists. And this person, American person, I knew well, and they told me that science, we have to be careful because modern science is a killer of religion. So then this gave me chance to think, and the Nalanda tradition that we follow in Tibet, as I have said yesterday also, the Buddha has said, O monks and scholars, just as gold is tested by burning, cutting and rubbing, likewise you should examine my teaching and accept it, but not because you have devotion to me. So, as I said earlier, Bhavviveka in his Tarkajvala has even called Asanga and Vasubandhu to be shameless. For their So Asanga was the founder of Chittamatra. And Chittamatra also was taught by the Buddha himself. It is very clear in the Sandinimochana Sutra. And so Asanga was someone who actually, based on that sutra, Sandinimochana Sutra, started the Chittamatra philosophical system. And so I found it quite strange and unpleasant when I saw this statement in Bhavviveka Starkajvala. And so since the Buddha himself has said that we need to examine his own teachings and not take them for granted and literally because of our devotion and faith in him. So using the knowledge that we have in the Indian classical texts, I thought that I could actually have discussions with scientists so that I could share this knowledge with them as well. And so having as a result of my discussions with the scientists, the view of dependent origination and is very helpful to them. And to us, we are able to learn so much about cosmology and then the particles and subatomic particle levels and so forth. Although there are explanations of the five elements on the basis of in the Mahayana Uttara Tantra texts and so forth, but they are not as precise and detailed as we find in science. So discussions, as a result of our discussions with scientists, it has been mutually beneficial. Perhaps I'm saying being too much. It seems that we, as the Buddhists following the Nalanda tradition, do not need to bowed, bent to the scientists, but it seems they are bending towards us. So you need to study well with a broad-mindedness, and I will have my prayer for your success, and you should also do your prayer and practice based on Manjushri, Buddha of wisdom. No girls? Are there any girls who wish to ask question? So you need to keep in mind that men and women are equal, boys and girls are equal. So perhaps girls could ask questions tomorrow. As long as peace remains, may I to, and as long as sentient beings remain, may I also remain to dispel the misery of the world. As a student, our teachers often tell us, as it is said in Sakya Lekshya, even if you were to die tomorrow, you should still pursue learning, because it is like depositing some money in the bank that you can use in the next life. So we are talking about past and future lives as well, but regarding myself, as far as I'm concerned, the boy says, I tend to forget what I have still learned the last year. Now, so he only says, me too. So whatever we have learned in this life, so I have this question regarding how is it that what we study and learn now can be used, like having deposited some money that we can use in the next life. So when we develop the understanding only based on learning, hearing the teachings, which is more or less based on, I mean, relying on the words. Of course, this you may forget things, but once you have used your reflection, once you learn through reflection more and contemplation, you may forget the words, but what from your experience, that the experience that you have developed through reflection and contemplation will still remain. So what you have studied in the earlier part of your life, in this life, you may forget, regarding that you may forget the words, but the meaning you will be able to carry on in the later part of your life. So similarly, it is the case with leaving the imprint in this life of regarding the meaning, although you may forget the words in this life, and this will be carried on in the next life. So we can see this amongst the siblings. For example, some siblings have difficulty learning in this life, and whereas others have can learn more easily in this life. So, of course, there may be differences in the neurons, neurological differences in the individuals. 7 billion people on this earth have 7 billion neurological differences, for example. But we cannot explain only on the basis of brain, but we need also to refer to the past life. So sometimes I also think that I felt that I found I sometimes could learn some points very easily, but others, other times I found them not easy to learn. So it seems this has to do with my imprints about certain things in the past life. So there are geishas who are very good learned geishas, and they find sometimes certain points very difficult to understand, but compared to them, I've learned them more easily. And at other times, I've found certain things more difficult to understand. So this has to do with past life imprints. She says she's a student at Sarah College. Dayo, Mariso, Tal Tomayo Mars. Sheba Toma, maybe. So her question basically is, if there is no beginning to consciousness, how do we posit a beginning of a sentient being? And His Holiness says there is no beginning to a sentient being as either. So when you use logic, there's no other alternative than to say that there is no beginning. Because if you posit a beginning to a consciousness or mind or sentient being, then how did that begin? I mean, what is that beginning of the mind? You have to explain. So modern science says that the universe started with a Big Bang. There is this view that Big Bang, there's the one Big Bang occurred, and from there the whole universe kind of started. But recently people are beginning to say that there are there have been more Big Bangs than one. And so you have to see what's the cause of Big Bang, what are the conditions for this to happen. So we have to explain the external world in relation to the living beings living in them. And therefore, since there is no beginning to the world as the external world, you cannot have beginning to the sentient beings. If you have to say there is a beginning of world, then the easiest answer would be because it has it was created by the by a god. So there's no other reason. So you don't need to resort to any other reasoning. But when you talk about causes and conditions forming the universe and so forth, then you only have to think that if you, I mean, whether you posit, use this, say this or that, ultimately you cannot have other alternative. So sentient beings are dependent on the external world, she says, isn't it? What about the formless sentient beings in the formless realms? Bitton is saying that it's quite a difficult, complicated thing to try to prove the three realms of existence. So we could maybe explain these three realms of existence on the basis of the subtle mind, the degrees of subtlety within the subtle mind. And so the desire realm beings are those who are reliant on, dependent on the external stimuli or external things like form, odor, smell, and sound, and so forth. Whereas the form realm In the form realm, beings do not depend so much like the desire realm on these elements. And in the formless realms, they have nothing to do with these elements and the objects. So if there is no end to the world, and if there is no end to the consciousness, but we do take rebirth again and again. Kaza. So when the world, the external world, kind of disappears, then where do the sentient beings? Where would the sentient beings be reborn? So a friend of mine actually said the same thing, that it's really difficult when you have to say that there's no beginning or end to sentient beings. So you don't need to be you don't need to have this kind of constricted thinking, he only says, narrow thinking. So there are countless galaxies in the universe that the telescopes that are used to look at the universe, we have more and more powerful telescopes, and they find that new and old parts of the universe are going away, and then new ones are forming. You don't have to worry about the world going out of existence, and therefore the sentient beings would not have any place to be reborn. You don't need to have that worry. So in the second chapter of Abhisamaya Alamkara, there is a debate on whether there is end to end of samsara or not. So samsaric existence, regarding an individual, with regard to an individual, it is said that you, by developing the an insight into emptiness, one develops your progresses along the path, and then once you have overcome all the craving within your mind, you would not be reborn through negative emotions and through the power of negative emotions. So I was boasting earlier, but partly it is true. Since my meditation on emptiness has helped me to reduce these very active negative emotions, so I could kind of infer from this that there is possibility for me to attain a state whereby I am free from the negative emotions. But what I need to do is to put effort, persevere in my practice by combining my study, reflection, meditation. And so an individual person would be able to end his or her samsaric life and go beyond samsara. But when we come to talk about all sentient beings, there is this also saying in the Kanjur, in the text, that there is no end to samsara. So there are four different reasonings. First one is reasoning where you use logic. And this is based on the reasoning or the principle of relations, and that in turn is many of the relational principles also are based on the principle of nature. So why is mind clear and aware? Why is the mind qualified by these qualities of clarity and awareness? It's nature. Why is fire hot? It's nature. So and then fire has the function of also burning and so forth. And so there is the functionality, principle of function. And so through these four principles, we could actually investigate into the nature of things. So we'll stop here. So I'll continue with the book. Please look at page 41 in English. Tibetan page 8. So we stopped at pray, let these ornament my heart on page 40. So these show the methods or the skillful means part of the practice. And then Domtempa relates certain things related to the leaders and rulers and lamas, the societal condition at that time, and he was actually, this is like singing a eulogy or a song of sadness. From afar, the hollow words of the false teachers sound wondrous and eloquent. The presence of these charlatans betrays the teachings of the scriptural baskets. When I see others, seek them as if they were the Father, the Buddha himself. I dare not part from you, O Father, even for a moment, instant. So they may look very eloquent, but they are not. They are not well versed in the teachings of the three baskets, and without any learning and experience of the Dharma, they actually pretend to be great masters. And so Dhammatempa says, when he sees them, so with regard to a lama or guru, we have the criteria given in the Vinaya, according to the Vinaya, and then according to the Sutra. According to the Sutra, there are the 10 qualifications of a master, such as being subdued and thoroughly subdued, and being compassionate, learned, and understanding suchness and so forth, which in turn comes down to the qualities by which one could subdue oneself and also help others. And so it is very important to have qualified teachers when it comes to the Dharma. So whether in India, Tibet or China, and also in America, in Europe, there are those who do not qualify these criteria that are mentioned in the text, but they pretend to be qualified teachers. Maybe about 20-30 years ago, when the people started flowing out of Tibet and China towards India, I met a Chinese who told me that at that time there were Tibetans who came from Tibet claiming to be king of Dharma. And then the Chinese devotees of these people respect them, and then bow to them. And then, as time went on, these Dharmarajas, what they were actually seeking were women and money. So there were such Dharmarajas. So he asked me if there is something that I could do. I told him there's nothing I could do from India. I live in India. And what you need to do as Chinese Buddhist should learn the 10 qualifications of a teacher as given in the ornament of Sutra by Maitreya. So you should learn them and understand these qualifications of a teacher. And then check those people who come as Dharmarajas, whether they have these qualifications or not. And not taking them as your teacher, master as such, but just someone who's explained the Dharma to you, and take them as friends. And then carefully check them. And then, once you find them trustworthy, then you could consider them your teachers or masters. Otherwise, just friends. And so this is up to you, and I cannot do much from here, I told him. In Tibet, in one place, a geshe gave a Ganjur reading transmission, maybe a few years ago, and because of this, people from other areas also, because they heard that Ganjur reading and transmission was being given, they went there, and they asked who was actually giving this, and then, even though they were already at that place, they heard when they heard that it was being given by a geshe, they actually turned around and left their place. Because if they were told that a lama was giving this reading transmission of the Ganjur, they would have stayed there. And so, lama, the title itself, seems to... and people seem to be considering others whether they are high or not on the basis of the title. So I have been saying that someone who is able to give teachings, a qualified geshe, could be taken as a lama and not a tulku or reincarnated teacher. Whereas there are tulkus who are not lamas, because there are tulkus who actually do whatever they like with they do not qualify as a lama, but they are recognized incarnations. And then there are those who are tulkus, reincarnated lamas, and also lama, who are recognized as a reincarnation of some master, and who have become learned and also experienced the Dharma within themselves through the practice. And so such a person is both lama and tulku. And so it is a sign of the degenerate age when people just rely on somebody because they have the title of lama and disregard those who have the title of geshe. Chusan Lama Rinpoche has written in one of his writings, a verse says, when you were recognized as a tulku, reincarnation, by the followers, it looks as if there was a lot of wisdom in the... But when the tulku actually becomes a disgrace to his past reincarnation, for example, some tulkus, after receiving the monastic vows, they actually become disrobed, and they disrobe, and then they become completely ordinary, sometimes worse than ordinary people. And Chöntala Rinpoche says, this really saddens me. The pretense of charlatans betrays the teaching of the scriptural baskets. So because Guru Yoga has become a very important part of our practice, we have the saying that we should have a pure vision of the Lama, whatever the Lama does, as being some something that is good, and also following the Lama, whatever he says. So Jerembuche, before going into the actual practice of relying on a guru, he gives these three outlines: the qualifications of the teacher who is giving the teaching, the qualifications of the student who is receiving the teaching, and the how the student should rely on the teacher. So he says in the Lamrim Chemo that those who wish to subdue others' mind stream must first subdue their own mind. And for this, you cannot just have certain practice that you call such and such, such as becoming someone who is very accurate in his divination and so forth. So such partial knowledge and partial experiences and powers will not do, help, but one should have one should subdue or discipline one's mind in accordance with the three trainings. And so this is what Jerembuche says in Islam Chemo. So if the teacher is somebody who is well qualified one, then you may be able to actually take his words literally sometimes, and whatever he gives, if it is in accordance with the teaching of the Buddha, you may be able to carry them out in your practice as well. Otherwise, if the Lama is not a qualified one, then it's very difficult. So the late Gen Losang Jatsola had told me that in one of the Daepung Kangsens in Daepung, and somebody actually said to a lama, that to the lamas, that if you want me to have a pure vision of you, don't do anything that you like. And if you want me to carry out your words, don't say whatever comes to your mind. And so here the father refers to the old father, refers to Adisha. So he was actually remembering Adisha. Even should one have performed good deeds thousands of times over, such teachers would snatch away one's very life from a single error, for a single error, when I see others seek refuge. And such evil leaders and kings, I dare not part from you, O most venerable father. Though claiming to know all the scriptures and treatises, the conceited decline to put their meaning into practice, when I see the others rely on such unworthy minds and conduct, I dare not part from you, O most venerable father. So a qualified master should have the qualifications of the three trainings, and should be more learned than the student, and should be someone who is diligent, and who has learned in the classic great texts. So even when continually propitiated with wasted exertions and goods, these wrathful, ferocious beings are never satisfied. When I see others seek them as saviors, I dare not part from you, from the dharma that alone is needed, though one ceaselessly strives to hoard out of greed. grasping at permanence with a view of longevity, to longevity, one's heart is never content. So when Dhammadhampa, at the time of Dhammadhampa, the leaders and the teachers, when he saw the what they were doing, he was saying, Dhammadhampa here says that he had his faith towards Adisha grows. When I see people depart, leaving all behind, I long to see you, teacher, you who are free from attachment. So giving teachings just to gain some wealth or offerings is not right. One's treasury may be filled with thousands of garments, but when I see one day death comes with wails of lamentation, that one departs naked, wearing no clothes at all, I long to see you, you who are swathed in morality. So a true practitioner does not will not have any regard for name, fame, and gains, but will sincerely practice the three trainings, and also on top of that, by taking one's own experiences as example, the pleasure and wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, they will relate the same wish to others that are with others. And therefore, from this time, as best one could, they would serve others. Even if they could give good advice, and so one's not has any regard for distractions in this life, such as name, fame, clothing, and so forth. Those surrounded by sons, daughters, and servants, one's enemy, the lord of death, subdues one by the neck. When I see that one travels alone to death with no companions at all, I long to see you soon, together with your divinities. Those swift-legged ones who ride a mount, who ride mounts in the four directions, if when chased by the enemy that robs them of their lives, I see them caught lifeless in their own deeds, but I long to see you in an instant, O space-like father. At first, they unite as if never to be sundered. Yet, at death, they part ways while beating their chests. When I see such misguided friendships arranged through household alliances, I long to see you soon, O a true master renunciate. So Dhammadhampa was a true practitioner who actually lived as a celibate upasaka, a layperson with a vows. And he was an excellent, a unique, great being. I long to see you soon, a true master renunciant. I, Gyewe Jungne, whose heart is never satisfied. At that time, Dhammadhampa was never satisfied and contented with what was happening in the society, whose heart is never satisfied. Oh, Father, have never countered your aspirations. So here in this ever-flourishing magical juniper forest, which refers perhaps to Redding, and so he was talking from his own experience, feeling sad about the situation. As I sing these lines aloud with a resounding voice, pray, seize them with your ears, as if hearing them clearly. The Lord of all three realms is the Blessed Buddha. That which brings him into being is the great mother, Dharmakaya, which is the wisdom, mother, a perfect wisdom, as which is the realization of emptiness. And those who have achieved this are the wise lords of the 10 levels. I pay respectful homage to the three jewels, my refuge. So the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So with regard to... So the Dharma does not refer only to the scriptures that are written, but it refers to the realizations within. And so the Buddhas come through that realization of the perfection of wisdom. And so the true Dharma, or Dharma jewel, is comprises the true cessation and true path. And someone who is qualified with these is true Sangha, Arya Sangha. By relying on the scriptures of my master's advice, I shall exhort myself, the lazy one, a little. Oh, noble three jewels, most undeceiving refuge. Oh, precious benefactor who grants ultimate objective. Oh, precious physician who heals the illness of afflictions. To never be separated from you, I seek your refuge until enlightenment. From now until the end of cyclic existence, I will be inseparable from the three jewels and the pursuit of others' welfare. So by taking refuge, the purpose of doing that is to help others, serve others. As one of you who asked a question recited this verse, as long as space remains and endures, as long as space and sentient beings remain, until then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. And similarly, which intelligent person would despair to ride the horse of bodhicitta, which leads one from bliss to bliss, gives you the courage to work for others. And so regarding bodhicitta, it gives you the real courage and confidence. It is that mine or treasure that dispels the poverty of sentient beings and so forth. And so you'll have, with bodhicitta, you are mentally happy, and because of that, you have great courage. And when some misfortune happens, you will not be totally disturbed. Your peace of mind will not be disturbed. And because your mind is healthy and you're happy, and therefore you'll also have good health, physical health, and you have long life and have good many friends and many beloved friends. Whether you know someone or not, doesn't matter. Anyone you meet is seen, you can see them as another human being who wants happiness, not suffering. And therefore, you will think of helping whatever you can. And also, you will not have jealousy, anger, and all these negative thoughts. As it is said by Shantideva, if you do not exchange one's happiness with the suffering of others, leave alone reaching Buddhahood, but even in samsara, you will not have happiness. And so, bodhicitta is that factor which will, which actually fulfills your short-term as well as long-term goals. Even if, even in the case of a sentient being, the more gentle and kind they are, they will have more friends around them, other dogs. So if a dog is friendly with his other companions, they will also stay with that dog. Whereas if there is a very angry, always barking dog, then the other dogs will not stay around him or her. So similarly, it is the case with us humans. when you have a kind heart and think of helping others, whoever they are, I mean, everyone will be appreciate you. Everyone will think that, oh, this person will not bully us, this person will not deceive us, and is honest, and therefore leave alone talking about the lasting goal, the happiness. But even in this life, if you are kind and altruistic towards others, I mean, you will be happy. And therefore, Shantideva also goes on to say, whatever suffering there is in the world comes through selfish motive. Whatever happiness there is in the world comes through thinking about helping others. And what need is there to say more? Look at the difference between the ordinary beings and Buddha. The ordinary beings who are selfish and Buddhas who are motivated or inclined to help others. And then with regard to the two texts written by Shantideva, Shiksha Samuchaya and this Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, and you'll find them complementing each other. What is not found in detail in one text will be covered in detail in the other, and so forth. From now until the end of cycle, I will be inseparable from the three jewels and the pursuit of others' welfare. Even if threatened, forsake others, and I will tear you your body and life, or I will tear your body and life. What use is my own happiness? I cannot abandon my parents. The beings of this degenerate age are so utterly corrupt. They sin themselves, but place the blame on others. They seek profit from the good deeds of others. With every joke, they collect mountains of non-virtuous karma. With their speech. Okay, hoarding wealth of this for this life, they keep away from happiness. On life's other shore, they lose too and fall into the abyss of lower realms. That verse. So Kuldar Rinpoche has said that we are more or less lost in the pleasures of this life, naively, like childishly. We may think ourselves that we are clever and intelligent, but we are lost in the pleasures of this life. So similarly, this is said here, yet thinking I'm most clever, deceive themselves and spoil their roots of virtue. The forces of Mara rejoice and dance with ecstasy. The forces of goodness, the gods, disapprove and denounce. Yet these pretenders still falsely claim to be Dharma practitioners. They fail to scrutinize even those charlatans they know to be deceivers and ignorantly take them as genuine. Yet they degenerate and insult the learned and industrious who practice Dharma perfectly, calling them charlatans. With a character devoid of shame and conscience, they return harm for help. When taught Dharma, they create negative karma in return. So many are there who return distortion for kindness. Even were I to shower them with profound Dharma instructions like rain, those with wild negative minds, undisciplined in heart, and since beginningless time, would be difficult for me to tame, for they do not practice the truth. Even when once in a million the shoot of the awakening mind grows in them, as they are lazy and lack both the foundation of morality and the force of antidote, fervently pursuing all times the goals of this life alone, many are snatched by the frost of five poisonous afflictions. without attaining the same degree or your own secure attainment, you cannot lead others to the place of enlightenment. Therefore, pointing my finger inward, I will counsel my mind in words beneficial for all occasions. Protect me against the frost. Frost of Mara and the hailstones, hailstorm of the lesser vehicle. Bear witness to whatever befalls me, such success or failure. That's the way His Holiness ends. So what we have covered so far is touches on the points of renunciation and seeking the happiness of the future life. And so tomorrow we'll do a generation of bodhicitta ceremony for that. And for that we'll also do the seven limb practice. So, since this teaching is mostly focused, for the students, since you are students, at this time, of course, the most important practice that you need to do is developing your wisdom, and therefore, I'll do the Manjushri Jenang permission practice. So there are many different types of Manjushri, such as red, yellow, orange, and white. For emptiness, the youthful Manjushri. For bodhicitta, the white Manjushri. In the Sakya tradition, the Arapacha Manjushri is considered most important. And so I'll do the blessing of that Manjushri. And once you have received the permission of blessing, you could recite the praise of Manjushri three times. And then recite the mantra, Arapachana, the mantra, one round of mala or so. And relying on Manjushri, you'll be able to develop the different types of wisdom, such as swift wisdom, extensive wisdom, great wisdom, or broad wisdom, and clear wisdom, and also wisdom for teaching, wisdom to for composing texts and debate. And so I have the experience that by relying on Manjushri, you'll be able to increase your intelligence and wisdom. I have done retreats also on Manjushri, and it definitely helps developing your intelligence and wisdom. And so the most important purpose is to do analytical thinking, critical analysis, or critical thinking, whatever subject you are learning. You just should not be satisfied with what you have heard or read, but analytical meditation is very important. Single-pointed meditation, of course, it's important, but if you don't have a good foundation of that, then you cannot do this fixing called meditation, focusing meditation at all. And so use your wisdom, intelligence, to develop your wisdom further, but as an aid to that, then you could rely on Manjushri and doing his prayers and praises and saying his praises and reciting the mantra.
Hi.
this sublime jewel-like bodhicitta arise in those who have not, in whom it has not yet arisen, and it may it increase ever more in those who have experienced it. The operations of evil thoughts and deeds of the negative forces, humans and non-humans who harbor malice through perverted prayer against each other.